And a pleasure to come in and sit with everybody for a while this morning. Excuse me. It was so quiet. I was amazed. Everybody was very still. And just a pleasure to be here. It wasn't like that some 40 years ago when Tim and I first entered this house with the Katagiris and a collection of people who took a flyer and raising the money to purchase this, at the time, run-down mansion on Lake Calhoun. At that time, it was a drug recovery halfway house. And the neighbors accepted us in part, I think, because we would be better than the development that was being proposed of multiple housing of some kind on the three lots here. So when I come here, I always think of Robert Persig and his wife Nancy, who, because Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance had become a bestseller, gave $20,000 toward the $60,000 price of the house. Now, today it'd be worth more than $60,000, but at the time when it was $60,000 and they gave $20,000, you can add a zero to get a sense of the gift that the Persigs gave. And then Tim and Linda gave a no-interest loan that was substantial. So that moved us halfway toward the purchase of the house. And I think you were repaid.
I was.
Good, yeah.
Believe it or not.
Yeah. Now, did you ever tell your father that you'd
no.
made that
one?
No. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Well, it's a sea change. So Tim and I both started practicing in about 1964 in San Francisco. He had a very wonderful close relationship with Suzuki, which I did not have. I was back here shortly after that, fleeing the draft and pursuing a PhD. So I went out there for sessions once or twice a year. So my experience of Suzuki was very limited, but very important to me. And I think we're Suzuki or Katagiri here, they would be pleased and amazed that even in the flyover country of Minnesota, which to Katagiri, when we started persuading him to come, was like going to Siberia or, you know, God knows where in the middle of this vast continent. So to think that this all developed, here's a house full of people working with this strange practice of just being or non-doing or zazen or meditation or mindfulness, whatever language we try to capture it in. We didn't expect this. And I was astonished last fall at when the Center for Spirituality and Healing brought Jon Kabat-Zinn here, that he filled Northrop Auditorium on a Friday night, 2,500 people, to talk about doing nothing. How many of you heard Kabat-Zinn or went to the retreat he did? Not. Okay. And then he gathered 500 people for an all-day retreat at some dance, big dance hall out east of St. Paul. So very remarkable. Couldn't have happened 40 years ago. Couldn't have happened. He was here 10 years ago. And something similar happened, but not like that. So I think we're all here on the coattails of something that happened in the 60s when yoga and meditation, Zen, Buddhism, Hinduism became a fascination of many in my generation. And it was kind of like these things were filling a vitamin deficiency in American culture. This lack of something we can call soul or spirit or I don't know what words we can use that don't suggest problematic connotations. Meaning, existential meaning. So in the 50s and 60s, we're in an incredibly wealthy culture. A lot of well-being. And a lot of angst that the industrial complex, the wealth that it accrued, was not adequate. It didn't feed the heart and the mind and the soul. So it happened, and now 50 years later, people of my generation, Tim's generation, have been working in often clumsy ways to try to translate, transmute, transfigure this thing we learned, in our case, from Japanese Soto Zen teachers, into something that would bring us all here so that we could sit together just in harmony, quiet. I was very impressed how quiet the hall was when I slipped in just before the first sitting. At my classes at the U, especially the undergraduate classes, everybody's squirming, scratching. You know, after 5 or 6 weeks, it settles down and gets better. But it's very hard to bring the body to stillness. So all of this stuff has come into the culture. And I was tracking a favorite saying of mine that I heard initially, I think, from Tim from Suzuki. So I got on the computer and Googled it, and it went back to Paul Farrell, the economist on public radio, who has written a book called Zen Millionaire. So if you want to become a millionaire and practice Zen, Paul Farrell has written the book. But it's a wonderful quotation, and maybe it goes back to beginner Zen mind, beginner's mind, but I'll throw it out now and maybe come back to it. Maybe Tim knows where it comes from. There are, strictly speaking, no enlightened people. There is only enlightened activity. So in the 60s, certainly I and many of my comrades, and I suspect Tim too, thought that we'd practice a while and then we'd be enlightened. Our tickets would be stamped. It would be all done. We'd never have to make effort again. Remember Bob Persig saying, well, you know, when we reach that state, I won't have to edit my book. Whatever I say will just come out, and it'll be perfect. So that was a grand delusion that I had. And slowly over 50 years, it's tattered at the edges. And then I was very pleased to see Suzuki making a comment that certainly emphasizes the ongoing effort of our practice to do nothing. Just to be here, to compose the body. And that takes a long time, to work with your body so that you can sit in a chair, on a cushion, on a bench for 15, 20, 30, 40 minutes in deep comfort. So I hope none of you who are sitting here very quietly and still were in pain, because now unlike our Japanese teachers, Tim and I would recommend adjusting. Not trivially, not because you've got a little discomfort, but if there's pain that feels bad for the body, then you work with that. That's a red flag. Let's find out how I can adjust. What kind of yoga might help me? Maybe I should sit in a chair. A chair is fine. I think you'll be enlightened just as quickly in a chair as in a yogic position. And working to compose the breath, letting the breath settle, letting the breath settle down here, letting it find its own natural, easy diaphragmatic rhythm, which it can find. I had a middle-aged woman in class who, after 12 weeks at the university, finally said, "It happened. My breath dropped from my chest. I've spent 40-some years breathing kind of anxiously up here, and I felt a drop where the diaphragm can do the work." So that can happen. Nothing we can force. We just have to be here, sit with it, observe, work to compose the posture of the breath. And then, of course, the big problem, the mind. How can we compose the mind? Oh, the mind is endlessly busy. My mind woke me up at 4 in the morning thinking, what the hell have I got to say here at the Zen Center? I thought, well, go back to sleep. No, I didn't go back to sleep. So I got up and looked at notes I'd worked on yesterday. Well, okay, add this, take out that, add this, take out that. So the mind does that. You know, it's the job of the mind. But when we've composed the body and the breath, and then we can watch the mind, we can let the mind anchor in the breath. And that's the only teaching I ever got from Suzuki or Katagiri for sitting. Simply be with the breath. Let the focus of attention flow with the breath. Again and again, flow with the breath. The mind goes out, bring it back. Be with the breath. So we're really composing, you might say, nesting Chinese boxes. The body, the breath, the mind. And someday, sometimes, we're lucky and we can just sit. Just be here. Child's play. Child's play. So it's not about austerity, not about improving ourselves. It's not really a self-improvement plan. It's a be here, happy plan. Be here in a good life plan. So it's been my pleasure for the last 15 years or so to bring this practice to the university, something I'd always wanted to do. When I was full-time teaching at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, the idea of a meditation class never got traction. Finally, they've done something like that. I went over there a few years ago and worked with a colleague. But until 15 years ago, the university had nothing in meditation or mindfulness. So that's part of this sea change that's happened in the culture. So that the center can bring in yoga, meditation, mindfulness, acupuncture, aromatherapy, shamanism, a whole array of exploratory avenues to health. And it's very telling that Kabat-Zinn, by coining the term mindfulness, was able to bring meditation let's name it for real, meditation, into the medical establishment at the University of Massachusetts Hospital. If he'd called it meditation, he would have been invited to leave. Calling it stress reduction and mindfulness, well, how do you argue with that? Can't hurt. If he wants to waste his time trying this, go ahead. And he was first invited to work with chronic pain patients. As he said, he'd go to the physicians and say, let me work with the patients who at this point are desperate. You don't want to see them again. They're simply asking for opiates. They just need painkillers. So he worked with groups like that and had remarkable success and documentable success. So now there's an explosion of research, double-blind studies, stuff done by Kabat-Zinn, Richard Davidson, many others in this area. So that's important to us. We're a rational, scientifically based culture in part. So we need to know that this is not just snake oil. Very legitimate desire. Very important. But the need is huge. There's a club at the university now called the Student Mindfulness Club. And I met with them Friday night at 6 o'clock, which I do occasionally. And I walked into the Mayo building, and there was a huge banner with a giant M for Minnesota. And the logo was, "We are the driven. We are the driven." So I talked to the students and said, "Well, that's great. How does it feel to be the driven? Who's driving you? Are they driving you into how much debt? How many late nights? How much employment to pay the debt?" Because when I was in college, I never had debt. "Are you being driven into depression, panic?" And I didn't say this, but in some cases, students are driven to suicide. So this is a huge bit of yeast at the University of Minnesota to leaven the lump of that mass of people being driven somewhere. And often we're driven by ourselves, of course. So it feels very good to me to be over there to have created credit offerings. Students can build meditation and mindfulness into a normal college schedule. No extra money. People of all religions or no religion. And it works. It works. But they have another problem. Everyone has an iPhone. And I discovered yesterday as I was working on this talk that the iPhone is really a stalker. Have you noticed that your iPhone stalks you? So it was sitting on the desk, and I just Googled maybe a Henry David Thoreau quote, which I love and might bring in. And then when I was done, it sat there and it started asking me questions. First it said, "Some things you can ask me." And then they start revolving. "Get college football rankings." "No, I don't follow college football." "Who is near me?" "I don't know." "Who do you mean?" "Find the next nail salon." "No, no." "Find Disney movies." "No." "Play Brian's voicemail." "Who the hell is Brian?" "I don't know, Brian." "Play my party mix." "I don't have a party mix." what's trending on Twitter? I don't know how to use Twitter. Play the hottest U2 tracks. No, I never listened to U2. Did the Giants win? I didn't know they played. Where is my sister? I don't have a sister. FaceTime Brian. Oh, Brian, I don't know him. Where's the NASDAQ today? I don't know. Should I look? Email Brian. I don't know, Brian. So, I've noticed in my classes, we have the Mayo Meditation Room at the U, which used to be a kind of a chapel, beautiful 10-sided room with a long hall. And especially this year, during break, students file out, they sit in a row on each side, facing each other, and they don't talk to each other. They're just, maybe they're texting the person next door, and that person is texting back. But, so we spend time talking about the importance of dealing with this stalker that is constantly filling you with all the toxic material that comes out of the world, which we have to know about, but we don't have to steep ourselves in it. So I came back from a little men's retreat last weekend. Tamara, oh, here's my wife, Tamara. You came to the lecture. Thank you. She threatened to avoid me. But Tamara was out of town. I came back on Sunday afternoon. And here's the New York Times Sunday edition. That made me kind of sick to my stomach. You know, normally I dive in, I read about all the horrible things happening in the world, and that clouds the mind. So it'll make me frustrated, angry, depressed. And I thought, I won't read it. I'll follow the advice of, who's the old Dr. Weil, said, take a news holiday. So I took a news holiday for a few days. Finally got back to it. That's good. But we are inundated with this material. And sitting here doing nothing, just being together in silence, is healing. It's healing. So, the title of this talk was Touching Frost Crystals on a Winter Window. That popped into my head when Kimberly kept bugging me to come up with a title. I thought, well, I'll talk about that. That was a metaphor that I first heard when I, back in the 60s, and it gave me encouragement, and that's really my only function here today, is to offer you some encouragement to the heart, in the heart. You know, do this. We can do this together. It's worth doing. And there's always that cynical part of the mind that after 10 or 15 minutes of sitting says, I'm not getting anywhere. My back is a little stiff. What a waste of time. Think of all the things I could be doing. Well, you know, we've all got that. So, all I can do here is say, well, I've done it for 50 years and it's getting better. It's getting better. I'll never stop. I never stopped. I had many fights with Katagiri, but I never stopped. So he might be surprised to see me sitting here. But I think he'd be pleased. But back in the 60s, I think it was Beverly White, whom did I see Cal in the assembly somewhere? Maybe not. Anyway, Beverly White was at that time an older woman. She must have been 45. And she was very interested in Zen and encouraging some of us in our 20s to practice. She'd been out west. She'd met Suzuki. She'd been to Japan. Her husband taught philosophy at McAllister. He was very interested in Hinduism and the Bhagavad Gita. But she gave me a sheet, and I was trying to figure out what it was. It must have been a mimeograph or a ditto, those old primitive meth. I see older people smiling. You know, this was before the laser printer and you pushed a button. And so this, and I wish I could find it if anyone's ever seen this metaphor, but the metaphor was for Zazen, for sitting meditation, of a child sitting at a winter window covered with frost. But the child wants to see the winter wonderland outside. So the child can take fingers, rub, 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 and then there's a little circle to peer through to see the beautiful snow and the trees. And then the child gazes, stops rubbing, and slowly that little opening frosts over. And that's Zazen. If we do it, we're rubbing open a little window through which we can see a much wider world. But unfortunately, we don't just become enlightened and then we can stop doing the work, making the effort, continuing to rub, rub, clear off that frost. And as I thought of that old metaphor again, I was reminded of what I didn't understand at the time, but Katagiri would talk about this. The frost itself is beautiful. We can think of the frost as our ordinary, complicated life. But that also has its beauty. So it's two things. And as I thought about that metaphor, I started paying attention to frost on some of the windows and saw some gorgeous patterns of frost. Yeah. But then if it's totally covered with all of my details and concerns and worries and anxieties, then I lose track of some broader vista. So the Zazen is a way of every day just opening up, clearing a little space, into a wider expanse, And another metaphor, and one of the only times I worked with Suzuki Roshi down at Tassajara was an occasion where he was working on his rock garden. This was during a sesshin in the summer. Now, I'm sure Tim was there, but we didn't know each other at that time. This might have been 68 or 69. And I was tapped along with a crazy guy named Alan Marlowe to work with Suzuki in the creek gathering rocks for the rock garden that he was putting together. So I was very happy to do that. We'd been sitting a number of days, very strict. My back ached. I was tired. But I got to work with the master. So the three of us went down to the creek, and first Suzuki instructed me to start carrying boulders back to his little cabin near where the garden was being constructed. And I did that for a while, and I got back, and he had Alan Marlowe in the creek with a maul and a stone chisel hammering on a huge piece of rock in the middle of this creek, Tassajara Creek. Not very wide, fairly shallow, but filled with boulders. And Alan was getting tired, and Suzuki said, "Well, Eric, come, you try it." So I got in the creek, and he pointed on this boulder about this size to a seam, just a very delicate seam, about 3 inches under the water. And he said, "Well, strike it there. Strike it there." And he wanted to break it apart so it was manageable to carry. So I worked and worked and worked and worked. Nothing seemed to happen. And then he said, "Well, I'll try some more work." He worked and worked and worked. Then Alan tried. So we went back and forth, back and forth. And it was quite wonderful. Beautiful sunshine. We're out of the Zendo. We're moving our bodies. We're with the master. It's hot sun, but cold water. Beautiful, clean water. But we were getting exhausted. And finally, Alan and I began to wonder what is going on. Is this a trick? Does he really think this can break? I'll just read a few paragraphs. "It's cool in the creek. Intense sunlight heats my back and neck and dances on the waters, surging around the stone. As my hand and arm return from each stroke, I see sparks of watery sunlight reflected up from flecks of mica in the submerged rock. For half an hour, we alternated the hammer and chisel, all three standing close. The icy water from the hammering splashing first on the hammerer, then on the two who wait. The sound of steel on steel pulses over the surging creek, ringing out into the little mountain valley. Alan and I sense the end of the work period coming. We work furiously, pressing against fatigue, flailing at times and losing our balance on the slippery rocks, pressed downstream by the icy water. We want to succeed, to accomplish this task for the Roshi." He watches quietly. "Finally, in what I know will be one of my last turns, frustrated, aches reawakened all over my back, I straighten up for a second and glance at Alan, who raises his eyebrows quizzically, little eye-rolling. Roshi, Suzuki, waiting to take his turn at the stone, smiles at us, his face wrinkling with delight. "Of course, I know you cannot believe the stone can split. But I know it can." And he had been a stonemason as a younger man. "Of course, I know you cannot believe the stone can split. But I know it can. We must keep hammering that place. It will split. Sometime it will split." Then, with a rising, inquiring, teasing intonation, looking at Alan and me, "Maybe you are not so sure. But I know. Someday you will know it too. All we have to do is just keep striking the stone." So I left after the retreat, went back to Minnesota or Idaho, I don't remember which. And I never knew what happened to the stone. So I've got to go back down there and see if that, if I can recognize two halves of that stone in the garden. Well, Tim, you must remember that garden.
Yeah.
And Alan Marlowe, who was huge, crazy. But notice how different that is than the metaphor of the frosted window. This is more in line with Zen stories where something suddenly happens and then it's done. Oh, I'm enlightened. My work is over. The stone is split. So there's some interesting conflict there between the two notions of practice. Suzuki's emphasis was just keep hammering. Just keep doing it. Don't worry about the future. Don't worry about the future. But have some confidence. I know the stone will split. But he didn't talk to us and explain why he knew. He just said, oh, keep sitting, keep sitting, keep meditating. Something will happen. Something will happen. And a third metaphor that I know Tim has given you many times was Suzuki's analogy of practice with walking in the San Francisco fog in his robes. And you can walk for half an hour. You're not wet. But then if you walk for an hour or two, you come back and you're wet. Very slowly, just penetration of something that rises up from the fog or rises up from the sitting. So it reminds me of a interesting poem that someone sent me by an obscure poet I'd never heard of named Thomas Owens. The experiment failed. The lead did not turn into gold. So here I am 50 years later, and I'm not a perfectly enlightened being. All my problems are solved. People are sending me checks. Cool. I don't have to worry about anything because I'm awakened. Well, that didn't work that way. If now maybe for Tim, well, I'll give him that, but not for me. So the experiment failed. The lead did not turn into gold. But the alchemist remembered the loot hidden in his closet. The alchemist remembered the loot hidden in his closet. So we've each got a loot hidden here in the closet of the heart, and we can start practicing and playing and making some music. And sometimes there's dissonance, of course, but if we practice and practice, some music happens. So this meditation, this non-doing, this zazen, this just being here now, is a kind of medicine for our culture. And it's interesting that Suzuki used to say that Zen was dead in Japan. Only these crazy hippies in San Francisco at Sugoji Temple would sit with him. The Japanese congregation wouldn't meditate with him. And at the same time, something about Christianity in this country was fading. Something was missing. So in the 60s, Hinduism, Buddhism, meditation, yoga, Qigong, Tai Chi, martial arts, all these things flow in to help supply a missing nutrient. So here we are tasting it, seeing how it works, seeing what health it can bring to our bodies and minds. So let me conclude by just reading you a favorite Hafez poem. And Hafez and Rumi, this is another area where something from another culture came in, starting in the 60s and 70s, to feed us something we were missing, to replace or to give us missing vitamins. And I always think of this sunrise poem when I'm here on retreat, and for the last 5 years I've sat the Rohatsu 7-day silent retreat, often with my wife, with Tim and Ted and others. And this porch catches the sunset incredibly, and the sunrise. And the first time I sat on that porch was with the Persigs at sundown about 41 years ago, and just saw this golden light coming in from the sunset. So here's a Hafez, and that we have it, we can thank Robert Bly that we have it, because he was one of those agents to bring in all sorts of material from other cultures in the poetic and spiritual world that now is a given. Rumi is one of the best-selling poets in America. He filled a need, this 12th, 13th century Sufi. How crazy is that? So here's a sunrise poem by Hafez. The sky wheel turns us into dawn and fills creation again with color. So walking over here, blue skies, sun coming up, gorgeous. Was too warm. Too warm. It should be about 14, but that's my preference. The sky wheel turns us into dawn and fills creation again with color. Let it be our weakness, this thirst love for the world. The sun coming up like red gold being poured. Let it be our weakness, this thirst love for the world. So 5 years ago, I remember at the first day of the Rohatsu retreat, a break came at 4:30. And that was just when the sun was going down behind the trees across Calhoun. And the whole porch was filled with golden light. And all of us austere, hard-practicing Zen students just gathered out there to admire the beauty. So this isn't about not admiring beauty. It's about admiring beauty even more than you might normally when you're just trying to look through all of your busynesses, anxieties, etc. So then Hafez switches. We've got the sky wheel, the turning earth, then to the potter's wheel, which is a classic image in Arabic poetry. Think of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. The potter's wheel moves, and shapes change quickly. Let the jar I am becoming turn to a wine cup. Let the jar I am becoming turn to a wine cup. So Hafez sees himself in the hands of God, Allah, the great potter. Let the jar I am becoming turn to a wine cup. Fill me with your love for being awake. Fill me with your love for being awake. So as many times as I've sat meditation in this room and fallen asleep, there are many times I've fallen awake. And this is something that develops, something that happens. I am no hypocrite renunciant. Call me this delicious substance you taste when you create new beauty. I'm no hypocrite renunciant. Call me this delicious substance you taste when you create new beauty. Be strong, Hafez. Work here inside time. Work here not worrying about a future heaven. Work here. That's why we come to the breath. The breath is always in the present moment. If the breath were in the future, we'd be dead. If the breath were in the past, we'd be dead. So when you come back to the breath, you're coming home, right here. Be strong, Hafez. Work here inside time, where we fail, where we fail. Now, if this was a self-help book, he would say, oh, where we succeed, right? No. Work here inside time, where we fail. Catch hold again and climb. So, I'm sitting with Wanda at the Rohatsu Sesshin, and I'm falling asleep. And then I catch hold, come back, over and over again, over and over again. Very simple practice, good medicine, and a pleasure to talk to you about it. Any questions, comments, complaints, concerns? Yeah.
1964 was an interesting year. In 1964, I was a rifleman in an infantry division, and I saw Vietnam coming.
Yeah.
And I expected at that point I would end up in the stockade and be dishonorably discharged because I told my first sergeant that I would not go. We were preparing.
Yeah.
But in order to find support, I first went to Quaker meetings and then found my way to Robert Aitken's Zen Center.
Yeah.
And sat with them for a while. Fortunately for me, I was discharged before my division left. And I went back to school. I actually ended up back in graduate school and I was pursuing a PhD. But the movement against the war pulled me in. Oh, and I should say, I tried carrying on my Buddhist practice, but at that point, in flyover country, in Urbana, Illinois,
yeah,
there was nobody to practice.
Yeah.
And then eventually, moving to Ithaca, New York, it was the same situation. So I found myself being drawn in to the movement against the war, and to the struggle for Black liberation, and I jumped in with both feet. Could not maintain my Zen practice. I discovered, however, that there were Christians who were very involved in the Christian peace movement. There were certain Christians who were involved in the Black liberation struggle. And bringing their spiritual understanding to those struggles. So I pursued that activism for 15 years or so. It ran its course. I ended up eventually going back to school again and pursued other activities. But I find myself now being drawn back in because of the state murders of unarmed Black people. This practice, as you mentioned, is centered in the body. And if you look around the room, it's mainly white bodies here. I know a very few Buddhist teachers who are active in this struggle. One woman I know from East Baltimore, Maricela Gomez, and she is a Buddhist teacher, practitioner, and social activist. And she has organized, in fact, mindfulness retreats for other social activists. So my question is, how can this essential practice, this Buddhist practice, be brought into the struggle?
Yeah. Well, a huge question. Yeah. And like you, I was involved with the anti-war movement. Felt bad that I escaped Vietnam with my master's and PhD work, in some sense, leaving the poor kids behind who ended up going there. So I think, from what I hear, I've not been to Oakland recently, but I hear that there is a burgeoning movement among people of color in Oakland to work with meditation and mindfulness. So I think it's happening. I think for each of us individually, when we get that guilt about simply sitting, like that selfish, that I shouldn't take care of myself, actually I think that takes energy away from a struggle to improve our culture. Because there's a point where activism turns in on itself and anger, and it looks like the enemy. That is, when the activist is so angry and hateful that he sounds like that which is angry and hateful in his opinion, you're beginning to blend. And I see that in the left and right in this culture now, where each side demonizes the other. So, and if we had time, I'd dig out some Thoreau, but he wrestles with this very question in Civil Disobedience. What do I have to do, given the existence of slavery in the South and the Mexican-American War? And he says, well, I can't right every wrong. And he was an abolitionist. He was very active with fugitive slaves. But he also said, I also have a right to pursue my meditations. And that attitude gave us Walden and Civil Disobedience, which inspired Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King. So I guess what I'm saying is it's very important also to take care of this heart. So then, when you have compassion and help to offer, it's not needy compassion and help. Because Suzuki at some point said, it's very dangerous to try to help people, because then you may be bringing your own stuff into it. Now, I don't know if that is a useful response, but
I think there's more personal work we need to do. And one can be motivated by love and not guilt, and by love and not anger. But the key thing, I think, is what we do with our bodies. Where do we put them? What do we do with them?
Yeah. Well, one thing we can do is establish peace within each of our bodies, and then act from that peace in the best way possible, in the most skillful way possible. Yeah.
I just wanted to thank you for bringing up people. Thank you for sharing, and I just wanted to make a comment that I appreciate you bringing up the piece about the phone, that I only, you know, like the situation with phones, because or computer, or, you know, I read or listen to music, but I do have a phone, and sometimes things happen with phone, and it's just bizarre, and it's real, and it happens to people, and I just appreciate you, like, validating that. It does help, you know, like, just, and that's what I've had to learn, to just live my life regardless, and, you know, and just, so thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Well, you can turn off all the little signals that tell you that my wife made me turn off the one that said, you have an email. I had a trumpet call. Da, 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 da. So you can turn it all off. And you can turn off the vibrate. When I'm meditating with students at the U and someone forgot to turn off vibrate, we're all sitting quietly and then, And then he or she is embarrassed. But I've had several students this term who have said, well, I've signed out of Facebook. Signed out of Facebook. So there are steps we can take to control the stalker. But we're holding in our hands what used to take a whole floor of computers at Cray Research. I mean, this is an incredibly powerful and compelling tool and a beautiful tool. But we've got to figure out how to work with it. And I saw the comment in that regard that we have Stone Age brains, but we're in a Space Age technology. And by Stone Age brain, we still react to reward and punishment. So as soon as that computer goes, or that iPhone sends you a signal that something's up, part of you says, oh, there may be something really cool here. And another part says, no, no, it may be bad. So that intermittent reward cycle just compels us to look. It's very deep. Well, any other?
I think we need to stop here.
Time to quit.
Sorry.
Okay, yeah, good. Enough. Well, thank you all very much for being here and sitting with me and each other.